So wise or right speech is one of the eight limbs or components in the Eightfold Path. It's part of the what's called sila, or the ethical or moral action component of the path, comprised of speech, action, and livelihood. And wise speech is described in a bunch of different ways in the early texts. Sometimes it's described very simply in the way that we chant it when we do the precepts, that it's, you know, it's the precept to speak what's true. Satya or satya is the Pali or Sanskrit for truth, to speak what's true. And then other places, it's fleshed out in a variety of ways. One of the beautiful checklists, as it were, that I really like and helps me a lot in my practice of speech is the guideline that wise or right speech should be four things. It should be true, kind, helpful, and timely. This is a really nice list. I'll say just a bit about this, and then I want to bust it out a little further. But this is a very useful list because it helps us orient to the complexities of speech in relationship. It's not just that the injunction is, you know, don't lie. That's a start. And of course, that's a complex start that in a certain way, I'll propose in a few minutes, goes all the way to liberation. But as a beginning, don't lie is something. But then it goes on. There's, of course, situations that you almost certainly have been in or could imagine where you might not be lying, but it's not the right time to say something, or it's not kind to say something. And so the guidelines, you know, speak what's true, that's a start, and then speak what's kind. Something can be true but harsh. And again, you know examples of that, you know, almost certainly in your friendships or in the public sphere. And so true and kind. Something can be true and kind, but not useful. And that's an interesting one. Like, oh, but I was being kind. It's like, yeah, but that it didn't help. Right? True and kind and useful. Like speech in this model is not just for connection, but it actually does something. Speech is part of the action set. And so all forms of speech have a result. Speech is part of what creates karma, creates ongoing momentum of action in the world. And so if speech is part of what creates ongoing momentum, then it's part of the ethical framework of conditionality, meaning if I say some words, they're going to have an effect. Things that have an effect either have a beneficial or harmful effect somewhere along that spectrum, and sometimes a mix, which is always complicated. But they're going to have an effect that's going to be perceivable in some way. It's going to increase pain or harm or danger, or it's going to increase pleasure or help or safety. And so helpful is in part the reminder that speech is an ethical act and that we can then begin to shape our speech through reflecting on whether what we're saying is helpful. True, kind, helpful. And the last one is really lovely, timely. Timely. You know, timely is when, you know, you're with your sweetheart and, you know, it's been a long day, everyone's been working, it's, you know, it's 1 a.m., you're crawling into bed, somebody's exhausted or everyone's exhausted, but there's something kind of chewing at you and one person or the other says, you know, hey babe, can we talk? And they might be getting ready to say something that's true and kind and helpful, but perhaps not timely, like it's not quite the conditions for it to really land. And it might be, maybe you're like, all right, let's wake up and do this. But you might not. You laugh as if you know the situation. Cheers to our lovely partners of all kinds. And to ourselves. Speech is always relational, right? partly. We talk to ourselves. We'll get onto that in a moment, too. So, in a very basic way, speech is ethical, which means it's an action, which means it has results in the world. For those listening out in, you know, I think too much about philosophy land, this is what's called performativity in modern philosophy. So you can go look up the speech theorist, Austin, J.L. Austin, in a little book that he wrote called How to Do Things with Words. And it basically is the book that established the very, very influential perspective that certain kinds of speech have direct effects on the world. Right? And he starts off with the examples of speech that is in a certain way magical or has an extra special effect on the world. So like a lot of speech is descriptive. This is a lovely teacup, is descriptive. But some speech is what he calls performative. Like, you know, like when somebody says, do you and this person want to be married? And you both say, I do. Those words have a force to them, a performative force. Just for fun, since we're going there, a locutionary force. Anyway, so words have locutionary force. But by the end of the book, it's actually dissolved because it turns out that you can't really separate words like that, that have that kind of force, from any other kinds of words. And very, very quickly, that philosophy realized that it's not just that some kinds of words carry force, but that all words carry force. And all choices of words carry force. And all translations and all descriptions do something in the world. It's a very Buddhist way of talking about speech as action. So speech is part of the ethical foundation of the path. And I want to talk about it in a particular way on a week, really in an era, where truth is a challenged thing in our country right now. And we're having hearings this week where the truthfulness of the folks speaking and the possibility that someone might be truthfully or untruthfully describing their life or their experience or their actions is really central, as it has been all these, you know, these last couple of years. Sometimes it seems like the ethical aspects of the path are kind of just the prerequisites, like they're the foundations. They're sort of like clean up your act so you're not too distressed in your mind, and then you can get on to meditating and concentrating and, you know, awakening with wisdom, etc. But to separate them in that way is a misunderstanding. Think of it this way. When, and I will use speech as the example, but this is true for all kinds of action. When speech is true, when it describes something that is coherent, a coherent description of the material world, and really a description of physicality in a certain way, like, I was in this room at this time. It's a description of what is happening, and it's verifiable in some way. Like, we could all say, oh yes, we were the ones here in this room at this time. In a material way. When I say that, there's a way that my speech doesn't cause many ripples, or it doesn't rub, it doesn't create dissonance with what happened. But if I was to go somewhere and say, oh no, I wasn't in that room at that time, even though it was your all's experience that I was, there would be a kind of friction created, an energy created, a heat in a certain way, because there's now something that is irreconcilable between our experiences. And it might come to nothing. Like, I could go somewhere else and lie about being here, and it wouldn't affect you, perhaps. But what if that lie turned out to be a really big one? You know, like, something really bad happened here, and I lied about it. Right? What would the lie be? The lie, in a certain way, would be an attempt to maintain a lower amplitude of energy, like someone accuses me of something. They say, oh, you know, that bad thing happened in your group that night. And I might want to not enter the field where there's that charged energy. I might say, no, I wasn't there that night. There was a sub there. This weird guy I hired, I don't know. I will never hire him again. Sorry about that. Right? I could try to get out of the increased energy that's coming by lying. But what it would actually do is it would create a greater energy, a greater force that would then have to be dealt with. And the problem with lying in a certain way is that you have to maintain it. And others would have to maintain it. Like, oh, then I have to, like, what, come back and, like, make everybody promise to be silent about something? Like, that's going to create even more tension in the world. And the suggestion here is something like the entire path is what do you do to allow your psyche, or the psyche of a community, let's say, or the whole world, perhaps, in some radical way, tend toward less dissonance or less friction. And sometimes I'll think of it almost thermodynamically, like, oh, if I just told the absolute truth in a gentle and kind way, in a certain way, I would be less and less far away from material reality. I would be resting into, this is simply what happened. And when I do that, even if what happened is painful, I'm able to rest into a different kind of tranquility in myself, because that additional rub or tension isn't created. There's some way that being transparently honest and kind, and etc., really speaking from wise speech, suggests that it's possible to settle into a deep honesty or non-denial about material reality. This is just what happened, as far as I can tell. And you might be wrong in your perception, and that's a different realm of practice. But to be clear about what you know is the path of least vibration, in a way, or least intensity, least added intensity. And this really culminates in the meditative practices, where the concentrated state in the mind or heart, in the body, really, is a state not just of profound focus, but of profound relaxation, profound release into tranquility and contentment. Tranquility is one of the deep positive qualities in this system. If we take this further out into practice, it can become something like, how do I, and this kind of language is used often, how do I align myself with reality? How do I become righted or aligned? The word samma, which is the translation for right or wise in all the eight limbs, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, the word is samma. It means right as in balanced. So right speech, right action, right livelihood. How do I write my alignment? And again, somatically, you can feel this as being not distinct from the central column of the body. How do you come in sitting to a righted alignment or into your center of gravity with the way things are? When I'm off my center of gravity, I have to clench to stay upright. Right? When I'm out of integrity, I have to hold something in order to not fall or stumble in some way. And so to come onto the center of gravity is, you can think of as a somatic metaphor for what happens when I come into integrity in speech. So Judge Kavanaugh is on the stand trying to defend himself against accusations of basically being a belligerent blackout drunk when he was in high school and college, and assaulting women during that period as part of an entire culture of assault in his fraternity, in his high school group. One of my friends, a wonderful teacher, Kimberly Ann Johnson, who I trained with in one of the Spirit Rock programs, and who does beautiful work, posted what Kavanaugh should have said monologue, and it was essentially a monologue that was it wasn't mean toward him at all. It was really kind. It was basically just like the straight truth of what he could have said, which I can't quote perfectly. You should go to it and look at it because it's better written than I'll say right now. But it was essentially suggesting that what he could have said was, I'm so sorry. When I was young, I drank way too much. I was under intense pressure. And by the way, I had no clue what to do with sexuality. None of us did. It was a really painful time in my life. And I am so sorry. I could have done those things in that state. And I vow never to, from this point on, seeing that and the results of those actions, I vow to work for a world where that doesn't happen, etc. Like, it was well said. Basically, him saying, here's what I know I did, here's what I don't know I did, but I could have, and I respect the accusation, and I'm so, so sorry, and here's what I will do from now, to move forward. And maybe that still means he shouldn't be confirmed, that's a different conversation, but what she laid out, and it was exactly these things. It was kind. It was truthful. It was fictional. But it would be truthful if he said it, is the sense. And what it would do, in a certain way, is defuse the whole fight. Because it's not defensive. It actually admits that, it says, I did wrong, I'm so sorry, I'll try to do better. And again, that wouldn't wash away the fact that he did it. Maybe then it would be appropriate that he was, who knows, at the very least, not confirmed. But the point is that truth is calming in the complex system. Truth calms discord. The trouble, of course, is that for him, perhaps, and I'll just say perhaps because I don't know him, and it looks like this, but my guess would be that for him to speak that would increase his internal discord, because to admit that which is what we'll call ego dystonic, like it would really shake his view of himself as an upstanding, a good, one of the good guys. To admit that would be stressful internally, but ultimately I think would be a move toward liberation for himself and others. If this makes sense, this model that essentially truth decreases the friction in a system, and lying or untruth and harshness and wrong speech in many ways increases the friction in systems, even if it's often done defensively, to try to retain non-friction, but it never quite works. I've said before in here that I lied to one of my friends when I was 15, and I've carried it for the last 32 years since that moment. And I've looked him up. Every few years, I look him up on Facebook. I try to find him just so that I can be like, I'm so sorry. So it's on tape. If we think of it this way, lying or truthfulness, adhering or writing ourselves in line with truth, becomes, in a certain way, the entirety of the liberation path. What if we go then internal to the inner monologue, the way we talk to ourselves, which is so often judgmental, and it's worrisome, and it's fretting, it's anxious? What if we think about anxious internal speech as a certain kind of lying to ourselves? In other words, the mind is going, it's going to be bad, it's going to be really bad, it's going to be bad in exactly these ways, and I'm sure that it's going to go wrong in these ways, and I'm really concerned about this. None of those things are actually true. What we know is that it's going to go in some way that is conditioned, and it will be a mix of pleasant and unpleasant, and we simply don't know what's going to happen. It is quite unknown. Any of us could not be alive tomorrow morning. It's really unknown. So in a way, anxiety, projecting pain into the future, basically, is an untruth to ourselves. And Buddhist teaching very often suggests the core reflections that we take on, the reflection like on impermanence or not knowing, is there, I think, to turn us away from an untrue internal monologue toward one that's more true. So like I can notice that I'm stressed, and I might say, oh look, there's stress. My body's vibrating, I don't feel very good. That is a direct, clear truth. It's not complicated. It's not a story. It's just like a description. Oh, there's stress. And then I can say, well, what's happening? Like, well, I'm under some deadlines and I'm really confused about what to do next. It's just true. Yeah. And then the idea, oh, I'm not going to make those deadlines and that will be embarrassing. Like that one, we're entering the realm of fiction. I don't actually know. I might make the deadline, I might not. I might be embarrassed, I might not. So then I retreat a little bit, I say, oh, that's not true. So I come back a little bit and say, what do I know about this? Like, well, what I know is that there's a deadline. I'm being asked to do something. And conditions are complex. How might I respond? And in a certain way, it's very straightforward. I might succeed or I might make the deadline or not, right? And I will deal with that the best I can. But once I hook into what's actually kind of materially, and again, this is a physical reality we're calling true, I tune into the physical truth, then in a certain way, it's not anxiety anymore. It's just a certain kind of clear-mindedness. And what might come out of that is an insight, like, oh, look, I took on too much again. Let's say no to something this week, you know. And that would be, that result, which might be a very useful insight, can only come through adhering to the truth of what's happening rather than spinning in the anxiety. So quieting the internal monologue in many cases can be helped by really asking. And this becomes, there's a popular modern teacher, a non-sectarian, certainly non-Buddhist teacher, who's been helpful for many, named Byron Katie. And her process is really about inquiring as to the truth of thoughts. She has this set of four kind of core questions where you come up with something. And you just ask yourself, is it true? Is it really true? And it's really pushing on this exact point. Because if you can discern that something you're thinking or saying to yourself is actually true, then your relationship to it will be very different than the realm that creates suffering. So one last way to think about this in terms of like tranquility. What if speaking and acting and thinking in alignment with truth, with what's materially happening in a straightforward and verifiable way, and adding this kind of preference for ease or smoothness of a relationship, so adding a preference for kindness over harshness, for instance, what we get is essentially a preference for less friction over more friction, a preference for calm over swirl or spinningness. So then I think about it often like, you know, the bowl of miso. It's swirling, the clouds are swirling, it's kind of fascinating, beautiful clouds. But if you don't stir it, it just settles. And then the liquid is clear, it's clear amber. And the sand is at the bottom, the chunky stuff is at the bottom. And What if the path of peace is actually just to align ourselves in all of these aspects, in our mind stream, in our speech, in our how we move our body through the world, in our action choices, more and more in alignment with what's materially true, and then responding appropriately without extra stirred upness, without extra untruth to what's actually happening. There's some way that the distress that we're in, that's really a distress about being out of alignment with reality, might just dissolve. And this is a little bit how the Buddha describes himself. You know, he got awakened at 32 or so and taught till he was 85. It's not like he disappeared. He just moved around non-contentiously. He did all these things. He built a huge intentional community. He interacted with politics. He taught thousands and thousands of people. Was enormously influential. Here we are, 2,500 years later, doing his thing in some way. An enormous mover of energy. But when he would say what he had done, in a certain way, it's like, well, I haven't done anything. Like, karma has ended. And I think what that means is what I'm doing is in alignment with reality so consistently enough that there's no extra ripple to grasp onto. There's nothing to muddy the water of this experience. And if that's the case, and the ancient image that we are reborn because there's still a ripple or still a movement in the force, there's still force moving through our system. This is why then enlightenment would lead to not being reborn. Tranquility has been arrived at in a final kind of way. And again, tranquility doesn't mean inaction. It simply means non-falsehood. So then lying creates a disturbance in the force. And truth is to align with the flow of the force as it is, more and more resting into that and acting from that rather than in opposition to it. So we started the evening with the listening meditation. So take a moment now and just open the listening sense again, the way we meditated with, and see if you can tune into a way that listening to things as they're actually unfolding interrupts the inner monologue, such that there can be a kind of clicking in or a focusing in to this moment. Take a few minutes to try that on again. Notice already if the inner words have piped up or begun again. See if you can sense what they're doing. What are they telling you? Are they describing something? Are they remembering or anticipating? letting that go. And just some space for reflections and responses here. Speech and its liberative action aspect, or anything that's up for you.
Experience that people don't want to hear the truth, so it comes. It's often experienced as not timely or useful.
Yeah,
I think for me, speaking the truth is maybe the easiest of the four. With I don't know if it's timeliness or maybe usefulness. People can't hear it a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah. If there's been a deep psychic investment in something being true that isn't, hearing the truth can be really challenging to, you know, who a person thinks they are. And so, you know, to offer that in a way that might actually be useful, that they might be able to take in and transform, might perhaps require a very distinct set of circumstances, like they would need to feel really safe or you know, really respected or whatever. You know, in a certain way, right, fragility, male fragility, white fragility, anybody fragility, might be an aspect of like, oh, I'm actually unable to hear the truth without fragmenting in a certain way. And so part of responding to that might be, you know, it might be appropriate to tell you anyway, to tell a person and just like, yeah, deal with it. It might also be like, yeah, what are the ways that this person could hear the truth in a way that would be useful. And that can be a whole body of work to find that with someone. For myself, if I want to bring something to someone that I think is true but they don't want to hear, sometimes what I'll ask myself is, in what way is it necessary that I bring this to them right now? Like, is it an emergency, or is it for their well-being, or is it because it'll make me feel better, or what's the realm in which it feels right to do this? And then if it really feels right, it's like, no, like, maybe they're causing harm, and I want to stop that harm, or they're causing harm to me, and I want them to stop that, or something. If I can discern that I'm trying to enact an ethical turn in the world, then I want to figure out, like, okay, well, that's the result I want. I want harm to stop, let's say. And then I might say, what's the best way to accomplish that? And it may be speaking this particular truth, and it may be something else. Sometimes I go through that inquiry, and what I find is that, like, yeah, I kind of want them to stop what they're doing, but I also want to be right in some way. And then I might pull back and be like, okay, is it necessary to push for that right now? And again, I'll often come back to asking myself, like, is harm being done that needs to be stopped? Recognizing that in myself, you know, all the ways that I'm fragile or delicate or, you know, can't deal with a given truth about myself as well. And that becomes a place I want to work. Or at least it's a place that I recognize I should want to work. People
are delicate.
Yes.
I feel like it's easy to see the boundaries of whether something is true and even kind and when it's a pretty objective thing, but as soon as you start talking about feelings, it all falls, well, I won't say it all falls apart, but I'm thinking a lot about how one of my communication strategies in a lot of my close relationships is allowing a lot of like takesy-backsies of, oh, I feel this way, but actually now a couple days later I've thought about it in this new way. Mm-hmm. And taking in both and like rolling with it, and I'm wondering how that kind of fits into this framework. Because it's not that in my relationships were like saying things too soon, I don't think. Mm-hmm. It's embrace at each step.
Mm-hmm.
But which one of those steps is true or, mm-hmm. yeah.
Sure, for sure. Yeah, it's a great exploration. I think the place that I go with it is that, you know, each one of them is true in the moment that they're being expressed because they're feelings, not, they're feelings that are a description of the present moment. So I could be like, today I'm frustrated, but, you know, yesterday I was enraged. And neither one of them is saying, you know, I am an enraged person. I wouldn't want to make that leap. I would really want to be, again, the most truthful with feelings is to describe them, you know, as really quite fleeting. You know, I was feeling enraged, and then I felt remorseful, and then I was confused, and then I, you know, and then a pretty person walked by and I got lustful and forgot that I was upset, but then I went back to being enraged, and now I'm, you know, bored.
Right.
And like the feelings monologue is a present moment, like, constantly changing thing. That's states. Just since you said the word, like a word about objective reality, because there isn't one. And this one's a hard one to express nowadays because this, taken to a certain extreme, supports
mm-hmm.
the fascist, like, you know, well, that's not my truth. You know, like truth becomes a really relative thing, right? And so, you know, I don't like the word objective because there's no way to get not subjective. But I like material. So I could say, like, it's a material reality that there's these exact people here. And you might have an experience where these people feel different than me. So I might say, oh, it was a really, you know, it was a really sweet and easeful group tonight. And you might say, actually, there was a lot of tension in the room. Those are describing feelings, and so we can both actually be correct in describing our own feelings. One of us might be, you know, not attuning to something, and that would also be true. But, you know, it's a relatively direct truth to say there were 9 people here tonight. And so that's a distinction we want to make. Part of the postmodern turn in philosophy was really to recognize that beyond some very basic material descriptions, there's not that much that can be called objective. And so and part of how that becomes an anti-oppression practice is that what that could become is the view or the practice of deeply valuing every person's distinct experience. So then I want to, you know, unlearn an idea that I might have that, you know, let's say an educated male perspective is the norm and other things are other than that. That's me forgetting my positionality, what we were talking about the last few weeks. And it's also just not true, today's topic. It's just not true. There's not a norm. And so I think we see this in the public sphere now in a way that folks who are concerned with this, much more than, like, if you read, you know, even journalism from 100 or 200 years ago, there's a lot less data in it. It's much more kind of opinion-y. But more and more now, it's like, oh, I'm not going to assert anything unless there's some basis in data about it. There were 9 people here tonight, you know. I wouldn't even then say, oh, yeah, you know, there were this many women and men here, because I don't actually know how everyone here holds their gender, you know, or understands themselves. So this thing about, like, there's less objective truth now, I think is actually correct. The place where that becomes problematic is when that, I think, recognition in our culture gets, we might say, weaponized to become a tool for disinformation, And that is a very challenging thing to fight against. I had a short conversation on Facebook, this is totally name dropping, I had a short conversation with Rebecca Solnit today on Facebook. I'm honored to be able to be in such contact with someone who's so brilliant and so helpful right now. But I had reposted a thing that someone had referred to after a writing of hers. I reposted a piece of Hannah Arendt, the modern philosopher, in 1971 talking about truth in politics during the Nixon period. And it was so perfectly what was happening now. I posted it. And Rebecca jumped on to say, except that, that was a time when the lies were actually even like trying to be plausible. And now we're doing something kind of different from that. They're not even trying to be plausible anymore. And it was an interesting little exchange, beautiful exchange, as always, when talking with a brilliant person like that. And really pointed to me this very difficult thing about like trying to be in alignment with truth. When you start to realize that there can't be a central cultural narrative anymore, that like the cultural narrative is that everyone has a distinct experience, and that we have to start emphasizing that over certain kinds of commonality if we want to move away from historical oppressions that are maintaining, in part through generalizations now. So that one's challenging, but we want to be very, I say we, I don't know who we is. I want to be, and many people I respect want to be, really careful about slippage in that realm, you know, in the realm of like how the media is being talked about right now, you know. So yeah, just describing feelings as they unfold is in alignment with truth. And then, yeah, you change your mind. You're like, yeah, I believed that, then I got some new information, and now I believe this, and that's just true. And neither one cancels the other out. Yeah? This moment. But it really was, you know, listening to pieces of the hearings that made me want to talk about this, because, you know, we're really... this thing that's happening now where folks in power of a certain ilk simply are insisting that a certain thing is true, even as the facts pile up against them. And Rebecca's good riposte to that really was that a growth in accountability is what keeps us in line with truth. Like, I could insist all I want that there were 40 people here, because my meditation group is the biggest, right? But actually, if I'm just accountable, any of you could be like, dude, there were 9. And I'd be like, oh, right. You know, it's actually in alignment with truth just to adhere actually to what's happening. So, other thoughts here?
So I get stuck on the kind one.
Yeah.
Because I think that, I just wonder how kind of healthy anger, healthy rage, mm-hmm. healthy, you know, maybe like heavier, sharper notes, mm-hmm. if you will, how they fit into kindness, mm-hmm. and on what level, because it may be kind for yourself and not for the other.
Absolutely.
And kind for the larger,
right?
And then unkind in the next layer, or I don't know.
Yeah, it's the thing about the kindness requirement for sure,
yeah.
For sure. You know, I think about the deities like Manjushri with the flaming sword,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all the fierce deities that are amazing mm-hmm. archetypes of that thing. What if kind doesn't mean nice, but it actually is a version of helpful that has a kind of emotional or loving quality to it,
mm-hmm.
that might be a little bit like, because I care, I am saying this. And it stings, but it's the right thing in this moment. And it might, one way we might think about that, you know, might be like, my kindness for all those who suffer from a particular oppression is making it necessary for me to speak this thing that in this moment is uncomfortable for this person or this class of people to hear. I think I can do that within the word you used, healthy. In other words, like, it's like it might be really correct to say, you know, this person is out of line, should be stopped, should not be in power, you know, should be confronted with their actions. That's different from saying, this, you know, this person is a stupid, ugly shithead who should never have been born, right? Which may be an accurate representation of anger, but it's not that it's not kind. It might actually be that it's just not helpful, but that helpful could be quite sharp. But kind, in a certain way, meaning like, because I love strongly, I have to say this, you know, and then I'm going to do it the most skillful way I can. You know, I imagine that those women, the survivors who confronted Jeff Flake in the elevator, could have said some really unkind things. And instead, what they did was really sharp and turned the course of this thing, turned his heart, essentially by saying, see us as human beings having this experience. And he may have perceived it as unkind, right? Judge Kavanaugh perceived some of what, you know, Professor Ford was saying as unkind when it was actually simply the truth of her experience, and he couldn't deal. So, you know, yeah, kind doesn't mean nice. And the Buddha was fierce, you know, when he would speak truth to power, as it were, to the power of the deluded ego. But ultimately, I think it would feel like, well, that was a kindness in the end. But I think, you know, it does make us think about some of the tone that can be, and this is, I'll use the word tone intentionally because there's a line where I don't want to fall over into what we would call tone policing, right? So there can be a tone of harshness within a very appropriate call out or call in or speaking truth to power. And that beautiful quote from Maya Angelou, you know, somebody remember it better than I. It's not for me to say how the oppressed one should speak in response to their oppression. She said it way better. It's Maya Angelou, of course, way better. You know, like yes, I accept the yelling of those oppressed, like as a basic maneuver. And then more subtly, I think this is something to be done from within a resistance movement. What is the most, you know, kind to ourselves, helpful, effective, cathartic, whatever is necessary, way to express what's been done? And then I think as a movement grows in maturity and wisdom, that expression changes, you know. And I think that can happen without condemning a perhaps younger, I'm not sure what that is, a more rageful expression, you know. I wouldn't say younger, but just a different thing, you know. Yeah. Anything else before we close?
other thing that came up for me was, you know, you reflected on so many different questions that you might ask yourself before saying something.
Yeah.
And then I thought about just the beauty and the innocence and the play of spontaneity,
mm-hmm.
and what actually is naturally arising in that moment,
mm-hmm.
Which may be the most true speech,
mm-hmm.
without all that consideration.
Oh yeah.
You know.
Oh yeah.
So I was just kind of thinking of that.
Well, you know, like, music theory is so complex, and like, you know, the way that if I really wanted to set up a transition to the dominant, going to the subdominant and then to the secondary dominant, maybe passing through the Neapolitan in this exact voicing would be really a cool pathway. So I figured that out and practiced that 100,000 times, and now we're jamming and it just comes. So like, spontaneity is a result of, like, good improvisation is a result of practice.
Right.
And practice can be pretty methodical.
Right.
And then ultimately, yeah, it's not like I'm, if I had to do that all the time, it would probably be a sign that my speech needs a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm immature in speech, and so then it's appropriate to do this. It would shut me up for a while,
yeah.
You know, until I practiced. And then once there's practice, you know, you don't have to think about it so much. You know, I'm sure you all drive the car without thinking about it, probably. But at a certain point, I remember trying to drive up the tiniest little slope in my hometown and being like, stick shift, 1985, right? I'm like, okay, it's the hill. I'm going to do the hill. The brake, oh, stalled out. Okay, start again. It's the foot, gentle shift, gentle. Like, lots of thinking about the process. Even a week later, gone. And then just spontaneous driving.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, practice.
Mm-hmm.
And then jamming. So, yeah. Yeah. I suppose the last thing to say about jamming, in a way, is that, like, my toddler is jamming, he's never practiced. Or he's practicing all the time, right? Like, trying things out, talking, and then he just sort of is, like, doing this free association jamming.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually, in a certain way, not a difference between spontaneity and practice.
Mm-hmm.
This is just what I'm doing. Like,
mm-hmm.
maybe the most useful thing anyone ever said to me about kids, about toddlers particularly, is that they're practicing all the time. It's like, he's doing his thing, but what he's practicing is, like, how do you run without tripping? How do you run and then jump over this thing and then do a little spin flip without tripping? And then, like, you know, how do you throw a paper airplane so it hits your papa right in the chest? And he just tries again and again and again, and every night we play, and he's just like, paper airplanes. Like, okay. And he's like, I'm going to hit you. I'm like, go for it. And it's just practice, 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 practice. But it's not separate from his spontaneous flow, you know? So maybe there's a kind of adhering to material reality, which he does in a tremendous way, but also in a kind of absurd way, where he's not telling any untruths, right? He doesn't lie, but he lives in a fairly fluid world of facts and experience, you know. But it's spontaneous in practice at the same time. So that also comes to me when you suggest that. So thank you for your presence tonight. Now, maybe every week we should say, you know, register to vote and vote. Get out the vote.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely to see you. Thank you for your generosity supporting us. And talks aren't on my website yet for the last several weeks because my site got malware hacked and then crashed and it's still a little bit messed up. But they will get up soon and things will get going.